Good morning, Connecticut, and to all our friends across the Sound, happy Valentine's Day. This is John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Thanks for tuning in to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People, bringing you even more information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. This morning, we're going to open our Valentine's Day For the People and close out Social Emotional Learning Awareness Week with more love from Sandy Hook, as we visit with Dr. Jeremy Richmond and the Aviel Foundation, which is launching its SPARK initiative to develop SEL leadership and compassion skills on a community-wide basis and beyond. Then we'll turn our focus to literacy and touch base with a couple of regional literacy programs to kick off a new For the People series called Teaching Connecticut to Read, focusing on the professionals, volunteers, and organizations on the forefront of literacy training. Then we'll close with Connecticut Office of Policy and Management Secretary Ben Barnes talking about a new statewide website helping residents and state employees fight fraud, waste, and abuse that cost state programs and us taxpayers tens of millions of dollars every year. You can check it out now at fightfraud.ct.gov. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Voquette, right after this news. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Food and Drug Administration wants you to know that many medicines used to treat colds and flu contain acetaminophen, a pain reliever and fever reducer found in hundreds of over-the-counter and prescription medications. But taking too much or more than one medication containing acetaminophen per day can damage your liver. So always read the label and don't take acetaminophen if you drink three or more alcoholic drinks every day. To learn more, visit fda.gov/OTC pain info.
In our continuing coverage of Newtown and recovery post 1214, we're pleased to be invited back to town here at NYA Sports and Fitness Center, joined by a couple of dear friends and a new friend in the room. We're pleased to be invited by Nick Hoffman here to NYA to join Cody Foss, who is a Sandy Hook parent and spokesperson and staffer here, and Dr. Jeremy Richmond, who you've heard on our program on the line and in studio with us before. He's co-founder of the Aviel Foundation, along with his wife, Jennifer Hensel, to honor the memory of their daughter, Aviel, who was among the 20 young victims of the Sandy Hook tragedy, which also took the lives of six of Aviel's educators. Avielfoundation.org is their website. They're doing great work. We'll have Jeremy Richmond unpack some of the details of the Aviel Foundation. But what we're really here today celebrating is sort of what's being described as the flagship initiative of the SPARK After School program, working to design and implement an evidence-based SEL situation, social-emotional learning, also leadership development and compassion skills being imbued on participants to build a community-wide initiative orienting the youngest generations, really, of community members here in Newtown, hopefully for a lifetime of leadership and engagement. So let's start with Jeremy Richmond. Jeremy, just for the folks that hadn't joined us in previous visits, could you give us a brief rundown of the Aviel Foundation and the work you're doing, and catch us up as to where we are today with that, and let us know how the SPARK program kind of came along and fits so perfectly into the work you're trying to do.
Well, as you know, the Aviel Foundation is committed to preventing violence and building compassion through neuroscience research, community engagement, and education. And in the few years that we've been working, we've realized that there are a number of clear risk factors that lead to a greater likelihood of engaging in violence and also potentially being a victim of violence. There's also a number of protective factors that we find are very scientifically entrenched and validated. And these protective factors lead away from violence and towards compassion, connection, kindness, and communication. And among those, we find that one of the most compelling scientific evidence of protection is a sense of social and emotional intelligence, these skill sets, these the ability to regulate your own emotions, to identify what they are, control them, to interact with others and recognize how your behaviors affect their emotions, and so empathizing and feeling compassion for your friends and your neighbors. The degree to which you have this emotional intelligence, this self-mastery, if you will, really predicts success in life, whether you define success by health, wealth, or happiness. It's scientifically established that the greater your degree of childhood self-mastery of emotional intelligence predicts your success in life. And so for that and towards that end, we wanted to start working with children to engender these skill sets and these habits early on. And so we developed a project within the Avial Foundation called the Spark Project. And we have a number of efforts in town. We're teaching brain health first aid courses in partnership with the Resiliency Center of Newtown. Sure. And we're also beginning a number of education programs and lectures. But our most excited and, like you said, our flagship effort is the development in collaboration with the NYA here, with Cody Foss and Nick Hoffman, creating an after-school program to serve right now the kids at the Reed Intermediate School in 5th and 6th grade.
Great. So, Cody Foss, how at what point was the development of the Avial Foundation or the Spark Initiative, what stage of development was that idea when you first heard about it? You're friends with Jeremy offline, so was this something you were in on the ground floor of developing?
Yeah, this project probably went back a year and a half. And I think the part I'm probably speaking for everyone in the room that I'm most proud of is not just sort of where we are now, but the collaborative partners that we've created along the way. So, I mean, there's a lot of people who can take credit for how this sort of started, but what's really made it, I think, a special program is that we are partners with Ben's Lighthouse. They help us out. The Resiliency Center has offered support to us. NYA Sports and Fitness, I don't think we could be more proud to have some involvement here and maybe change our identity and the culture or the perception of what we can offer our community. So I think while this has been a long step from the planning stages to where we are now, I think the proudest moment we all have is the partners that we have doing this together.
And it goes from local to global, though. You're involved with the Life is Good outfit.
Yeah, so Life is Good, which is the connection that Nick made for us, is probably what has given us the best opportunity to make this an extremely successful and sustainable project, because they have the ability to, and have already demonstrated that, train our staff in social-emotional learning strategies to work with kids. So you go from creating an environment where you have a lot of well-intended, trusted people that can provide information to kids to suddenly having a deeper skill set to provide these social-emotional learning traits. And that, for us, what we've experienced in the last few weeks already has been a tremendous asset.
Right. So let's go back to Jeremy. Jeremy, tell me a little bit about how you and your team contributed to the development of the program, and then we'll go back to Cody for, like, how it actually rolled out in real time.
Well, like I said, we were very keen on finding ways that we could build these skill sets, these social-emotional skill sets, not just teaching them academically in the four walls of our school, which, everybody's not aware of, in the Newtown School District, all our schools do teach, in an academic sense, these social-emotional learning skills. Mm-hmm. What we wanted to do is go one step further, and we want to model these skills. We want the parents, the community members, to be able to understand what these skill sets are ourselves, mm-hmm. and model them for our kids so that it really becomes engendered, and those self-mastery skill sets can then maximally benefit the success of our children and also clearly benefit our lives.
Yeah. And wherever they go on to.
In the world at large.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
And so we reached out to a number of community leaders trying to keep it open to wholehearted collaboration with anybody that's interested in helping, specifically Newtown, but with a vision of Can we scale this to other communities in the future and make this sort of the flagship model community? And in the process, like you said, I have a good friendship with Cody, and he does business meetings, fortunately and unfortunately, usually running quite a bit. So we ran a few miles around Fairfield Hills. And
got it all worked out.
And yeah, and he had if you've ever worked with him, he has very creative, out-of-the-box thinking ideas, and he came up with this this idea to maybe bring some life into the NYA, and you know how those things kind of organically grow. We got other people involved, and everybody had really great ideas, and it all started with Cody.
So how much of yours and your team's and the science end of what you're doing came into play when you were crafting like the hands-on engagement and activities that these young people are now doing after school?
Actually, very little, because it turns out a lot of people have done the homework for us. Oh. And for example, through Nick Hoffman's previous affiliation with the Life is Good Kids Foundation, they said, we do this. We teach these social-emotional skills through a different lens of creating superhero skills, and the power of optimism, and it's a wholly innovative and new way of looking at and approaching it, with such an effective means of creating a new operating system. Here's how you think. Here's how you work with kids. Here's how you can view the world yourself, and it moves the paradigm quite a bit. And so we didn't have to create a whole lot of curriculum. We didn't have to reinvent it. We just basically layered this operating system onto the after-school program that Cody had thought up, and found ways that we could expose children to new interests and new things that they probably wouldn't try on their own, to get them to reach out, explore, experience, and to build their skill, their emotional intelligence, and their comfort and empowerment.
Just no insect eating yet, right?
Not yet.
That's phase two.
That's right.
We joke, but thanks for joining us. If you just tuned in, we're with Dr. Jeremy Richmond. He, along with his wife, Jennifer Ansel, co-founded the Aviel Foundation to honor their daughter, who is among the 20 young victims of the Sandy Hook tragedy. We're also with Cody Foss and Nick Hoffman at NYA Sports and Fitness Center in Newtown. Cody Foss, also a Sandy Hook parent. So as we're talking about this program in the last 5 minutes or so that we have, Cody, I'm the kid whose mom or dad or mom and dad says, here, we're going to bring you over to NYA and you're going to check out this new program. So young person of what age comes through the door, and then what happens?
The age right now is fifth and sixth grade. And part of the process, the application process, is we try to screen what your interest might be. And we have a few categories that we're looking at in particular. One is arts, one is music, one is wellness, recreational wellness, and then one is fitness. And the idea is it's kind of a challenge to the child and to the family, and then on our end to make it a good experience for them, that we want them to sort of stretch their position with some of these activities. So we're asking each child to choose a wellness elective, a art elective, and a music elective. And the idea is that we realize we might be putting them in a situation where they may be uncomfortable, or maybe have failed before, or just something about it, the experience previously that didn't work. And if we do our job, and what's been so great about Playmakers, if we create this environment where the kids feel safe, supported, comfortable, and they're more willing to try it, then we have a really unique opportunity to change some perceptions about what the arts might mean to a child, or what wellness might mean. The one area that we're really trying to stick to a fixed curriculum is the fitness part. We feel we have some responsibility to teach children how to take care of their bodies. So we try to make it as fun as possible, but we are asking them to stick with it.
I guess it's one of those things that the more regularly you do it for life, the longer your life is potentially going to be.
To do more spark good.
Right. And I saw my buddy Joe Prock say he must be engaged with the musical portion of the activities. What do you got going on with him?
Yeah, so Joe is a rock star for us in the sense that he relates to kids on levels that most adults don't.
Yes.
And we couldn't ask for a better person in that position. In addition to working with kids on all levels of instruments, he has a nice challenge coming up next Wednesday. One of our team-building events is we'll be going to WestCon, and the children will be performing the national anthem. And he's got
at a sporting event?
Yeah, at a basketball game. It's actually a doubleheader. So part of it will be the national anthem. Some of the kids that have chosen the dance elective will be working with the cheer squad to do part of that. And then at halftime, we're doing sort of a fun team-building event that will allow all kids to sort of participate without any of the risk of embarrassment of either singing or dancing if they didn't feel comfortable. So everyone will be included.
And engaging the audience?
Yes.
Oh, great. Fantastic. In the last few minutes that we have, we'll go back to Jeremy. Jeremy, from my prep, I'm seeing to help incentivize community commitment and engagement. The Spark program is looking to securing scholarships and awards and commitments from colleges, university, and respected corporate partners to reward the initiatives and be wrapped up in this whole movement. How's that going? And if you had an opportunity to shout out for expanding those partnerships, I'd give you that opportunity.
Yeah, we are wholly motivated in this endeavor now. People are really signing on to it. I think what we're seeing is a big pendulum shift away from the "I've got mine" sort of mentality and to a real heartening social entrepreneurial world where people believe that, yes, it's okay to make money, but it's more important, or at least as important, to do good in the world. And we're finding a lot of large corporations, universities, schools, find that in their culture, the best leaders are the people that are emotionally intelligent, not necessarily the experts in whatever particular field they are, not necessarily the best computer programmers or engineers or biochemists. Organic synthesizer.
More intuitively.
But so people the most important quality is people that know how to motivate, lead, inspire, and get along with people of different backgrounds and coming from different perspectives. And when we say that's what we want to engender here, and by the way, that's the mission of the Spark Project. That's very much in the wheelhouse of the mission of the Aviel Foundation. We want to give you, the resource and the pool to draw from the best candidates that are going to be your next future leaders. Those are going to be people that went through Spark programs that grew up in communities that were engaged in this way, so that we envision in a bright future communities that are Spark communities, communities that recognize this value, and these Fortune 500s are going to say, "Wow, let's prioritize that kid because they went to, they come from those kinds of schools. We'll put them through schools, and we'll get them to help us put them through schools."
Fantastic. Well, it's I really very much appreciate you letting us sit in with you at this early stage. It's so exciting to have the prospect of following this development from seed to tree, as I'm sure it's going to grow and flourish in the coming months and years. We want to thank Nick Hoffman for having us here at NYA Sports and Fitness Center in Newtown. Cody Foss, also a staffer here at NYA and a Sandy Hook parent. Dr. Jeremy Richmond, co-founder of the Aviel Foundation, with his wife Jennifer, to honor the memory of their daughter, who was among the 20 victims at the Sandy Hook tragedy. Aviel Foundation, A-V-I-E-L-L-E foundation.org is the website. You can link to Spark off that. Shouting out also Rob Accomando, who couldn't be here, executive director of Spark, but he will be with us on chapter 2. of our visit with Dr. Richmond and the Spark Project and the Avielle Foundation. So for now, thank you very much. Please check out aviellefoundation.org to learn more about all the great work that they're doing to prevent violence and build compassion in communities by fostering brain science research, community engagement, and education. Thanks for having us.
Well, today we're going to be kicking off a focus on literacy that you're going to be hearing about on this program occasionally throughout the entire year of 2016. We spent January taking a look from 5,000 feet at a number of issues that are affecting the most people in Connecticut. And sadly, we're still finding that there are a lot of people out there that have an extreme challenge in grasping the English language and many folks who can't read. So we are going to kick off this series with a couple of agencies, neighboring agencies, actually, that have reached out to us to promote both training and awareness. We're going to start things off this morning with Donna Violante. She's executive director of the Literacy Volunteers of Greater New Haven. Bernadette Holodeck is also on the line. She was on the board of directors for Literacy Volunteers of Greater New Haven and is now working on fundraising. Speaking of which, you can get to know and support the Literacy Volunteers of Greater New Haven at a great event coming up, a fundraiser called the Scrabble Challenge. And that is happening on March 30th, beginning at 5:30 p.m. at JCC of Greater New Haven over on Amity Road in Woodbridge, just a few clicks up from the Merritt Parkway Tunnel, as you may know it if you travel around that way. So Literacy Volunteers of Greater New Haven serves adult students from Ansonia, Bethany, Brantford, the Valley Communities, Derby, East Haven, Hamden, Meriden, New Haven, North Haven, Orange, Seymour, Shelton, Wallingford, West Haven, and Woodbridge. A big footprint, and their goal is to create a community where 100% literacy is the norm. Ladies, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
So, Donna.
Thank you.
Donna, let's start with you. Tell us a little bit more beyond that austere introduction about your agency and the great folks that work with you and the wonderful angels that come to volunteer.
Right. Thank you so much. Our mission here at Literacy Volunteers is to empower adults through literacy. And the way we do that is by training and supporting a large number of volunteers who hold free classes for adults in Greater New Haven, the Valley, and the Meriden-Wallingford area. We offer two major programs. The first is our ESOL program, which is English for Speakers of Other Languages. And it's a very large and growing program as our area becomes more and more diverse with immigrants and refugees to this area. And we concentrate on conversational skills for those individuals and then work into reading English and eventually writing. Our second program is really for native speakers, for people born right here in our country or from English-speaking countries who really need to improve their reading skills and are really motivated to do that because it's going to change their life. Mm. And last year, we touched and served almost 1,400 students at about 39 different tutoring sites with free classes throughout our area. So it's pretty extensive what we do. And the amazing thing is that we did that with about 240 volunteers.
Mm.
And the volunteers love doing it. They get a tremendous amount of reward from this because they make such a positive impact on people's lives.
Yeah, as I talk to more and more people that are engaged in the literacy movement, as a matter of fact, I was having a conversation with a big award-winning country artist, Phil Vassar, the other day, and he's been even involved in the literacy movement. But as I talk to folks on the ground, especially here in Connecticut, they're so gratified because a lot of times you do volunteer work, and there's a lot of time in between when you get trained trained and started, and you start to see results, or you see the end result of the work that you're doing. But literacy volunteers sometimes not only see a result every time they interact with a student, but sometimes when they're in a room with 6, 8, 10 people, they're seeing results from all 10 of those people in one session. So that's got to really, really, put the fire under people to do this and help more folks learn how to read.
That's absolutely true, John. And you know, we don't only see the improvement in the reading gains when we test people, which is great, which is wonderful unto itself, but we also see improvements in their everyday life. People who can now read to their children, people who can help their kids with their homework, adults who for the first time ever are able to take a driver's test, or read a bus schedule, or read, the medical information and prescription information that they're given by their doctors. Mm. People start with us and then move into larger adult ed programs or GED programs. Some even end up applying for more advanced education at our community colleges.
Yeah.
So, our tutors witness that, and it's very, very gratifying.
Yeah, and I guess you made an important point, Donna, because I understand a lot of these tutors look beyond even the person that's right in front of them that they're helping to learn English or learn how to read, because we hear from so many experts around the world, really, about early childhood education that mm-hmm. the parents play that most important role, and reading to the child from birth is shown make great advancements in children's literacy. So if the parents have a hard time, or they're discouraged from trying to read to their children as soon as they're born up until they're, they're old enough to read on their own and read to the parents, that's a great thing. I don't want to burn through so much time, however, without also letting folks know the other ways that they can get to know your agency or support it. Of course, there's always monetary donations, but they can also come out and have a great time at this Scrabble event. So we're going to ask you to just take a quick break and hand over the phone so we could talk to your former board member, Bernadette Holodak, who is now heading up some fundraising initiatives, and she's going to tell us about this upcoming Scrabble Challenge. So thanks so much for taking a few minutes to get us oriented on our series this morning, Donna. Donna Violante is Executive Director for Literacy Volunteers of Greater New Haven. If you'd like to learn more about their outfit, it's lvagnh.org for their website. Tell you everything you need to know if you need to find them to learn how to read or to become a tutor. So let's switch gears now and let's have some fun with Scrabble. Bernadette, are you with me?
I sure am. And I can also say that they can go to that same website and find the information to become a sponsor or to play as a team. I joined the board back in 2003 and was approached by someone who I knew that was the president of the board at the time. And they had been doing a small Scrabble tournament that was very small. But as the agency was growing over the years, they needed to grow the major fundraiser as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I came on board, and I started helping with doing this Scrabble tournament. And then when I went to my first annual meeting, which we had students speaking about the impact that the agency had on their lives, it made me involved with the agency for these past 13 years.
Great. So
the Scrabble tournament is our presenting sponsor is Tariq Fareed Foundation. And over the years, we've had continuous support from the Knights of Columbus, New Haven Register, the Yale New Haven Hospital, Community Foundation, First Niagara, New Alliance, all of these wonderful, wonderful people in the community who stand behind literacy.
Great.
Well, you come out and you have a great time. You play as a team of four.
So if one person has a better word than the other, then you just play off of each other.
Right. And so
we
this
have
is
wines.
I apologize. I've only got about 30 seconds left. So this is for adults or younger people. There's no.
Well, it's for adults or college students.
Okay. Super.
So we do have competitive teams and the friends and family, students, if it's college level, and corporate.
And they can get all the information for this event as well as finding out everything else that they need to know. If folks reside in the towns of Ansonia, Bethany, Brantford, Derby, East Haven, Hamden, Meriden, New Haven, North Haven, Orange, Seymour, Shelton, Wallingford, West Haven, and Woodbridge, literacy volunteers of Greater New Haven, Meriden, Wallingford, and the Valley are there for you, and they invite you out to their Scrabble Challenge Wednesday, March 30th at JCC of Greater New Haven. It begins at 5:30 p.m. If you need the assistance of literacy volunteers, you can get in touch with them. And if you'd like to support them, become a volunteer, learn how to become a literacy volunteer or support them like Bernadette has, either maybe being considered for the board or working on some of their fundraising or other initiatives, go to lvagnh.org. Our guests for this first piece of our interview this morning are Donna Violante, Executive Director, and Bernadette Holodock, who's the former board member and fundraiser for Literacy Volunteers of Greater New Haven. Ladies, thank you so much for helping us kick off this important series, and we are so happy to be able to support you in your efforts to try to get 100% literacy here in Southern and Central Connecticut. Thanks for being part of the show. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to our Valentine's Day edition of the award-winning For the People right after this news. A Mexican fiesta party to benefit the Animal Haven is going to be held at Enchiladas Restaurant on Wednesday, March 9th from 6 to 9. Enchiladas is located on Whitney Avenue adjacent to the Whitney Golf Club in Hamden. The Animal Haven is a private nonprofit charitable organization serving the greater New Haven area since 1948 with a no-kill shelter whose mission is to provide a temporary, safe, and caring, humane refuge for homeless adoptable cats and dogs and to place those animals in a quality adoptive permanent home. Tickets to this benefit are $20 and include a taco bar and quesadillas, along with drink specials, raffles, music, and games. Tickets are available at Enchiladas, the Animal Haven, or by calling 203-249-7355 or just going to theanimalhaven.com. We're on the line now with Tammy Jackson, a familiar voice to folks who are regular listeners, longtime listeners to the award-winning For the People. Tammy, you've been at this quite a while. We've been friends a long time. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about your trip into the world of literacy.
Oh, wow. Well, I've been at the job now for 6 years, but I was a volunteer for about 10 years before that. So mm-hmm. It was a passion that I've had for a long time and am happy to still be growing and helping people with their literacy support.
Yeah, I remember when we first met as when you were just a volunteer saying, how could we teach more people to read?
Yeah.
And here you are running the thing. And recently rebranded. It used to be a Milford exclusive outfit, and now your outreach is extending to what communities?
Oh, well, we're in about 10 different communities, and we're Stratford, Milford, West Haven, Orange, as far as Derby, Oxford, some of those in the Valley. So we're a little unique where we do a one-on-one tutoring. So a lot of our students will seek us out because they want that more individualized teaching style rather than a classroom setting.
Great. And as a result of that, in some respects, the need for tutors at your division is a little bit heightened, and as a result, you're on the cusp of beginning to offer a new training class, right?
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so we have, we've opened two satellite offices. One is at Milford Library, and one is in Stratford Library, and we're going to be having a tutor training class in Stratford in the first week in March, March 2nd. It'll be for 5 weeks. We've already had students and tutors coming to the time when our program coordinator is there and meeting with her and already signing up, and there's been a great buzz in the town of Stratford, so we're excited and excited that they are welcoming us and know that there's a need and that we're willing to work with them to help.
Could you explain a little bit of the dynamic difference between the experience that an individual, let me rephrase that, for people who may be looking across the landscape of where they can access literacy training, is there some differential as to the folks that might want to seek out a classroom situation versus the type of more unique one-on-one coaching that you do out of Literacy Volunteers of Southern Connecticut?
What the difference is, or
are there folks who have a little bit more functionality, maybe a little bit more outgoing, maybe a little bit more familiar verbally with the language or anecdotally, but don't have the skills? Are they more? Do they flourish more or get better results in a classroom setting versus in the one-on-one that you guys offer?
Well, it's always hard to say. I mean, people come here at different times in their lives. They've been here for extended periods or short periods. Mm. So sometimes when people come to us, they might know a little or they might know a lot. So English is spoken in other countries, but sometimes when they get here, you know, you've got idioms and slang and just conversation pieces are extremely different than learning it in another country. So they may be more prone to join a conversation class because then you actually have that contact with other people and those communication styles. If you're a beginner, it might be intimidating. A lot of times we'll find students don't want to be in a classroom setting. They're embarrassed. They're insecure. You know, I'm going to say it wrong. I don't want to talk out loud. So, and then other people don't, it doesn't bother them, and then they want to be in a class. So it just depends on the individual, which is why it's kind of nice that we have several options to offer someone when they come in. We do have small classroom settings as well, you know, 3 to 5 students, but the one-on-one is really what we focus on and have the largest majority of our students paired up that way.
Yeah, it's, I guess when you envision a literacy training class and you hear about the kind of demand that we're both hearing about from you and the folks that we spoke with over at Greater New Haven, Donna and Bernadette, you're imagining, you know, these packed classrooms full of people, like kind of working through it step by step. But in fact, it is these either these one-on-one or these more boutique classes that that are more the norm on your end.
Yeah, I mean, we had a student once, she was a nail tech, and it was really important for her to communicate with her customers, to know the names of colors and things that would relate to her business so that she could be a better employee.
Sure.
So that was really important to her, and that's all that she cared about. Mm-hmm. Some other people may want to really have a wider range of skills and be able to work with their teachers. You know, if their children are in school, that will be important to go to PTA meetings or integrate into a setting where you're in a school setting, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And we talked with Donna and Bernadette about how early childhood education starts with reading from birth. And if the parents can't read in the language that the children are going to be expected to use when they hit pre-K, and they don't have that foundation, that then they start off with a little bit more of a challenge. So this is all great. So your training class is starting in early March. Folks can come and sign up now. Tell them how they can get a hold of you if they're interested in the kind of offering that you have at Literacy Volunteers of Southern Connecticut.
So they can go to our website if they want to just kind of read a little more about what we do here. It's lvsct.org, or they can give us a call at the office at 203-878-4800. There's always a volunteer tutor on the desk, so they can ask them plenty of questions about what the class is like and what it's like tutoring someone and what the training entails, so they can get a good idea of what it is that they'll be asked to do and who they'll be helping.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much for taking some time and catching up with us on all the great stuff you're doing. Congratulations on the expansion of your jurisdiction. I know it makes a lot more work, but it does so much more good, so much greater potential to bring the expertise that you have, not only as a leader of the agency, but a person that's done the frontline work as well. Tammy Jackson is Executive Director of Literacy Volunteers of Southern Connecticut. Once again, get to know those folks at their website, LVSCT. Find out how you can help support them with a donation or by becoming a literacy volunteer yourself. Tammy, great to speak with you, and we'll talk to you again soon. It's been a while since we talked to Ben Barnes. He is Secretary of Connecticut's Office of Policy and Management, OPM. And for the most part, when we see Ben talking in the media, he's talking about financial issues and budgetary issues in Connecticut. And it's always great to share some additional good news. We learned just a few days ago that the state of Connecticut has launched a website to help in efforts at fighting fraud, waste, and abuse that cost state programs and you, taxpayers, tens of millions of dollars each year. So, Ben, welcome to the program, and thanks for taking a few minutes to talk to the folks across the state about this important new project. Tell us a little bit about the ramp up to launching fightfraud.ct.gov.
We have a significant amount of money that we spend every year on healthcare in particular, through the Medicaid program, but also through our state employee and retiree health care programs. We insure state retirees who live out of state. And with that comes an extraordinary number of individual claims that are paid out. And while the vast majority of those are appropriate claims, high-quality medical services by appropriate providers, and the claims are fine, there have always been, and we're trying to reduce this, some number of claims that are fraudulent, where people don't follow the rules for how to, what kind of claims they should be filing for. The claims are don't reflect the services that were provided. The services were not appropriate. They made up out of whole cloth in some cases, and we need to have an active ongoing program to root those out. This website is only one part of a large multi-agency effort to reduce fraud in our, particularly in our medical assistance programs.
Well, tell us about your which agencies you're partnering with.
Well, the Department of Social Services, which is the agency that runs our Medicaid program, has for a long time maintained a program integrity unit that does audits of providers and identifies fraud based on a whole series of different approaches. They get tips from the public. They analyze trends and in utilization. They look at all the data that comes over the transom in the form of claims that are filed by providers, et cetera, and they try to identify fraudsters, and they pursue those through audits and, in some cases, through referral to law enforcement. However, a few years ago, the legislature said they wanted us to redouble our efforts in order to find some budgetary savings. We would rather cut money out of fraud than cutting it out of other areas in the government.
Program, sure.
So while their target was maybe a little steeper in the short run than we would have liked, just because you know it's always hard to predict how much money you'll save by fighting fraud, we took the effort very seriously. We built a group under OPM's leadership involving DSS, other human service agencies, the Attorney General's Office, the state's attorney, and others. We added some expansions to what we call the to our ability to under what's called the False Claims Act for us to receive civil settlements in the event of people who've lied in their met claims for reimbursement to the Connecticut medical assistance programs. And that effort has, I think, really begun to pay off. We've developed more technology-intensive ways to develop leads, so we're better able to comb through the mountains of data to identify patterns which might suggest fraud.
Well, let me stop you on that point, Mr. Barnes. This seems like these transient operators are kind of insulated, like a kind of like a closed shop effect. So, by utilizing fightfraud.ct.gov, how would an individual outside of the scheme or beyond the direct perpetrators of the fraud, how would they know or even suspect that something might be wrong to be able to then tip off Connecticut officials to go after it?
Well, I mean, I think that there are a lot of ways that you might. I mean, we all know what a regular. I mean, if a local provider that you do business with appears to be engaging in a practice that doesn't make any sense to you and might be reflective of fraud, I would encourage you to report it. I mean, if there's someone out there who, you know, if you go into a store and you see that they are, taking a SNAP card or a food stamp card and giving cash back to the to the person who's presenting it, that may well be fraud. You're not supposed to do that. If there are people who are, treating patients who at a medical practice that you're at, and the treatments take no time at all, and appear to be executed on healthy people who are lining up in the waiting room. If you think it's fraud, we'd like to know about it, and we'd like to take a look.
Oh, and with that, you bring up an important point, because anyone who makes a tip doesn't automatically launch an assumption of guilt. It simply launches the vetting of that accusation.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we investigate lots and lots of things, if we can identify, if we hold ourselves to very strict standards for identifying overpayments or fraud, and we certainly would take that responsibility very, very seriously. But we need evidence to do that. I mean, for instance, some of the cases that have happened have been reported on and concluded involved providing unnecessary services, unnecessary claims. So if a physician or a provider is appears to be billing insurance or appears to be asking you to sign off on claims that are beyond the level of the services that you provided, we'd like to know about that. Okay. Because that may be an indication. I mean, I understand it's complicated. Sometimes many of us, myself included, may not understand every aspect of the medical procedure claiming process, but to the extent that we see something going on that we don't understand, I would rather have our investigators look into it and make sure it's on the up and up.
Yeah, and I have to believe a lot of times people feel in their gut or instinctively that something just seems wrong, and there's nothing wrong with making that suspicion or concern, bringing that to the attention of your office through the fightfraud.ct.gov new website. And you also have a lot of situations, I guess, where people who may be receiving services or for whatever other reason, they may be wary of some sort of retribution, or that they'll end up having to come back around and be sitting in court pointing a finger at somebody saying, yes, I saw him or her do that. What wherewithal does this site provide for anonymous tips, or perhaps maybe we should come at this by talking about the experience that somebody has when they click on fightfraud.ct.gov?
Well, our website allows for a whole variety of fraud to be reported. We connect to the national fightstopfraud.gov website, where you can report all kinds of frauds, whether it's a mortgage fraud or student loan fraud or identity theft or cyber crimes. I mean, there are a whole series of links that you can make to appropriate federal agencies. In addition, we have within the state system, we would allow you to report healthcare fraud, workers' compensation fraud, fraudulent, you know, use of state services and some of the major human service programs. There are connections to the tax department and others if you want to report fraud. I mean, as to whether or not it would, you know, the ability to remain anonymous is certainly something that I'm sure we would attempt to respect, although there are a great number of laws related to that. We may, in fact, need to follow up on an allegation, but we certainly would welcome any kind of tip that people want to provide us, and we'll sort through it and try to get to the bottom of it.
Mm-hmm. I also see that an important part of the website provides ways for the public to report suspected aspects of unfair competition. Could you explain that?
Unfair competition covers a series of things that might come under the auspices of our Department of Consumer Protection.
Mm-hmm.
So that would involve you know, things like price gouging or misleading advertising that someone is doing.
Oh, I see. So there's
sort of unfair trade practices that are done at the, you know, if a store advertises something for sale and then doesn't have that available, or is otherwise engaging in some kind of unfair practice in the marketplace, and then our Department of Consumer Protection would investigate that.
I understand. So this all came from the Governor Malloy's Interagency Fraud Task Force in 2013, and you did talk a little bit about the challenge to try to quantify how much the effort is worth it in terms of the dollars saved in mitigating or stemming these fraudulent practices. So tell us a little bit about the numbers that you've been able to rack up just since November 2013.
Yeah, well, since then we can quantify tens of millions of dollars in savings where we have identified particular bills that we don't have to pay because they're fraudulent. We've recaptured money that we've recouped money that we've paid out in what we later discovered to have been fraudulent circumstances. However, it's what's the hardest part to look at is if, say, there's a medical provider who is billing for services that haven't been performed, and we catch them based on you know, activity over a several month period, and that's worth you know, tens of thousands of dollars. That may seem like we've stopped tens of thousands of dollars, we've saved that money by not paying for those claims. But if that provider was, without our efforts, going to go continuing to bill for those services into the future, we may well have saved many times more than the nominal amount that we identified in our investigation by shutting somebody down.
Yeah.
So program integrity has enormous impact on the long-term costs of running a program if everyone who's involved knows that they cannot undertake organized exploitation or organized fraudulent claiming or anything like that without being caught, then we can limit our expenses to those that are necessary, and the savings there are quite considerable. So it's very hard for me to say, you know, we've considered trying to be more aggressive about how we quantify the savings when we've uncovered and disrupted a fraud, but we've tried to stick only to those numbers that are easily demonstrable based on the, you know, the recoveries or the claims at issue. But again, I think the savings are much greater than that. And frankly, this is other people's money we're talking about.
Right,
this is public funds, and integrity is terribly important. So it's
money.
Worth investigating frauds, even if it costs us a few thousand dollars to uncover a relatively small fraud that may not have had huge financial consequences, but undermines public integrity and undermines confidence that the taxpayers have in their government services.
And also from a person's perspective, if they suspect, or even if they know there's some fraud going on, and but to them they're thinking, oh, you know, it's just a few dollars, or it's just $20 or $30 every month or every visit or whatever, and then they hear about this fightfraud.ct.gov website, maybe they'll be inclined to go there if they start to begin doing the math and saying, wait a minute, if this is involving some sort of a provider, and when I go in the waiting room there's always 30 people in front of me and 30 people behind me, then you start adding up that few dollars or that $20 or that $50, and boom, I mean, these are my tax dollars. These are your tax dollars, right?
No, it's absolutely true. I mean, and there's no question that we are able to eliminate tens of millions of dollars of expenses every year. Tens of millions of dollars, you know, it varies. It's hard to exactly quantify what that number is, but those are sums that are enormously consequential to our ability to provide all the services we want. I mean, I hear criticisms all the time from people about one budget cut or another, or one area of expansion or another that people are advocating for, which is smaller than that. Having those resources available to provide more services for people with developmental disabilities, or to expand mental health services, or to reduce taxes. All those are much better uses of money than paying for the hidden costs of fraud.
Right. Kind of capitalizing on the established idea of see something, say something. The state of Connecticut has launched a website to help efforts at fighting fraud, waste, and abuse that cost state programs tens of millions of dollars each year. To date, tens of millions of dollars already saved for taxpayers, and all it takes is to go to fightfraud.ct.gov. Our guest today, Ben Barnes, Secretary of the Connecticut Office of Policy and Management, cluing us in on the work that they're doing and the importance of if you even have a suspicion that somebody might be defrauding the state of Connecticut and you and I as taxpayers, go to fightfraud.cd.gov. Ben Barnes, great to speak with you on this important matter. Happy New Year, and we'll talk to you again soon. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and do not necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audiences and communities we serve, you must make your request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours at 869 Blue Hills Avenue in Bloomfield. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Vayette. I'm John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for another installment of the award-winning For the People. Or listen to this and other For the People podcasts under the podcast tab at our radio station website or on iTunes. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.